Elchim Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals.
Okay, hello and welcome to the De-Risking Podcast. And before you panic and think you're on the wrong channel and should be listening to Radio 1, I'm going to invite you to hold that dial. And why I'm inviting you to hold that dial is really because we want to talk about how important getting the investment mix is to somebody who's coming up towards retiring. And that really is both an investment design, but it's also looking at wider considerations. So we want to share with you some of those considerations and to give you a little bit of a framework, perhaps, to think about this when you go and review your default for the members. Because apparently we are all getting older, so that means that at some point this topic will be relevant for everybody. So without any further ado, just to say I'm Simon Chinnery. We actually, funnily enough, we all have solutions in our title. So there is a common link here. I'm head of DC Client Solutions. Veronica Humble is head of Investment Solutions. And John Southall is head of Solutions Research. Have I got that right?
Yep.
Great.
Yes.
We've cleared the first hurdle. So hopefully you're all tuned in to De-Risking. This is going to be, I think, a very interesting area because I can almost guarantee you we're going to talk about at least one thing that you may not have thought about. So without any further ado, first of all, just to set a little bit of parameter around this, both Veronica and John, we're talking about the default. We're talking about what are the factors that go into considering a default as the default starts to de-risk? You know, because I imagine there are quite a lot of factors, and we want to try and give some kind of signposting here to the trustees listening. So, Veronica?
So, thank you, Simon. I think when we think about the investment default, it's important to just take a step back and think kind of who are we talking about? Mm. And it's very, very easy to think about a very, very precise thing for a particular abstract individual, whereas actually these abstract individuals just don't exist. And this is where we come in saying that, people are different, they're retiring different ages. They are doing different things. They generally don't actually make decisions far in advance. Mm-hmm. We would all love to have someone who, at age 55, says, well, I'm going to retire at 65 and a half, and this is what I'm going to do. And then they just hold on to that. And it has implications both in terms of us thinking about what are these uncertainties and parameters we need to think about from the member perspective, but also it has huge implications for John's side, because these are the parameters that go into models. And these are the things we need to consider from a mathematical point of view as well.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, just, John, before we go to you, I mean, that kind of cloud of uncertainty means, you know, people aren't really, this, what do they call it, cliff edge of retiring isn't really happening anymore. And therefore, it's fine that we identify that it's a mess out there, but actually, propositionally, we've still got to work out something that has to, you know, have a strong framework to actually work. Is that's right?
Yeah. Yes, that is entirely correct. Because if our models and our brilliant investment strategy only works if we know right. for certain that something will happen, well, that's not great, because we know for certain that it probably won't happen. Okay. It needs to be quite robust to accommodate different types of behaviours.
Okay, so John.
So sort of taking a little bit of a step back, I think there are a lot of different risks and factors to take into account when you're looking at this de-risking journey. And the main things to really focus on are that we're targeting an appropriate level of return at each stage of the journey, but also that we have like a diversified strategy. So there's various factors that go into an investment design proposition. So these cover things like the influence of contributions into a scheme, which has a fancy name of human capital. There's behavioural considerations. There's all sorts of fancy models you can build. But there's also, very importantly, as we've been discussing, this uncertainty around demographics. So one important example of that would be retirement date uncertainty.
Mm.
And so this is really saying people don't really know exactly when they're going to retire anymore. So it's important that we allow for this in our models, because our models are only really going to be as good as our inputs.
Yeah. I mean, that's really important, isn't it? Because I imagine an awful lot of people, they join a company, they set a retirement date, if they even do that, but they just won't think about it. And then, you know, if you've got a standard de-risk that is de-risking to that point, you know, and I haven't even thought about it, and as you said, Veronica, I'm probably not going to think about it until, I don't know, a few years before retirement?
I think actually very often a few months,
right.
Even. This is what we're finding in our research, is that it's not 5 years, it's probably like 2 years, 18 months, or even less. And, you know, it's very easy to say, well, they should know better, but people know that life happens, and a lot of retirement decisions are based on life events, and there is things that prompted people to actually think about it. Also, it's actually quite scary. So, kind of to do the budgeting exercise, think about how much you will need. And given that we all bombard our members with negative messages, oh, you know, you haven't saved enough, etc. So people just procrastinate and do this almost at the very last moment.
Yeah. So with all those kind of risks that you're referring to, John, do you prioritise one above the other?
So it's interesting. So if you come back to this retirement date uncertainty and you look more closely at the influence of that, what you find is it can actually encourage a more return-seeking strategy.
Mm.
So you have to be careful. And as I'm an actuary, I like to caveat my answers a little bit.
You mean you're careful?
I'm a little bit careful in that it does depend on how you look at risk.
Right.
However, having said that, under what we believe are sort of fairly realistic behavioural assumptions, reflecting how investors really feel about good versus bad outcomes, our models do indicate that de-risking early is really the biggest sin in some ways, and it can be potentially quite detrimental to outcomes. And in particular, that sort of de-risking too early seems to be much worse than failing to de-risk prior to an unexpected early retirement, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think it does. But that's quite counterintuitive in a way, because the world in which I grew up was kind of very much about, you know, I don't know, 10-year de-risk. And it was the right thing to do, because why would you want to take that risk as you came up to retirement?
Yes, and I think that makes sense if you know exactly when you're going to retire, and if,
right.
And also if you're going to, you know, you're going to annuitise when you retire.
Yeah.
If you don't know when you're going to retire, and you're also possibly uncertain about what your post-retirement strategy is going to be, then you have to be a bit more careful and nuanced about how you look at it.
Yeah. And there are two things here which are also important to have in mind. First, that the schemes are different.
Yeah.
And we know that some actually are all over the place. People retire later, come back to work, etc. Some are actually fairly confident that what they're doing is appropriate, and even if they're de-risking into cash, because, for example, they have a fairly senior workforce with a lot of DB, and so they all take their DC pots as 25% tax-free cash, and they have fairly good confidence around that behaviour. So, of course, that makes perfect sense for them. And another thing is, actually, what we started to observe since pension freedoms is that people go into income drawdown, and that is not because they actually want to go into income drawdown and take income, but because they want to crystallise their pension pot and take 25% cash again. And then that is not a conscious investment decision. This is just, well, can I take my cash, please? Well, but you need to choose something. Well, I'll choose this. And
then that means I can get my cash. cash.
Precisely. Right. And then they don't do anything, which is, again, it's a totally rational decision, but we've classified them as accessing their pension pot. They are staying in something that they haven't reviewed, and they can stay in it for quite a while. They can, for example, do it at 55 and then retire at 65 or 70.
Right. John, I mean, on this point about, you know, this uncertainty and de-risking too early being the biggest risk, but with all this uncertainty, I mean, you can't just get rid of the risks, can you? Unless, as you said, you know, I know exactly when I'm going to retire and I'm definitely going to buy an annuity.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I don't think there's no way to get rid of all of these risks. Mm. However, you can improve the risk-return trade-off to some extent.
Okay. Do you want to talk about that a second? I mean, why I'm interested in that is because you said earlier about, well, just perhaps as a an opportunity to remain a bit more with invested into risk, because you're going to get potentially a better return from that. But what happens about that? I'm in that, but am I doing that because I don't know how long it's going to be before I retire, or I'm not thinking about that at all? Like, you're making a decision for me that I should remain invested for longer. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. So I think it's just reflecting that until you're clear about what you need to do, you need to trade off the kind of the risks of doing something that's not necessarily ideal. Mm. So if you end up retiring earlier than you expect versus if you retire later, both of these have their downsides. But what we find is that the downside from de-risking too much on balance has a more negative impact.
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. But one thing I would say is that we don't want to get too hung up on this particular aspect of risk, which is the date that you happen to retire at. There are lots of other factors involved in the whole retirement journey. So, and some of those factors would actually act in the opposite direction. So they would encourage sort of more conservative strategies. And so one of those is actually parameter uncertainty, which we can talk about later. But one important one is just financial capacity to deal with losses.
Yes.
So as you get closer to retirement, if you remain in like highly volatile assets and you suffer a large drawdown on those assets, it's going to be quite difficult to recover from that, because you have a limited amount of time to increase contributions over. Whereas if that happens when you're 40 and you've still got a couple of decades or so, you can just sort of increase your contributions marginally and sort of recover. And so you do have this greater financial capacity when you're younger, and that is... There are lots of different factors involved, but that is one important factor.
This is really interesting, Veronica, on this point about, you know, the ideal versus the real world, that you have to get a balance, don't you, between those two points?
And it's interesting. So I'll jump in onto the capacity for loss as well, because traditionally we all talk about attitude to risk, and it's great, but actually, it's from our point of view, it's probably not the most pressing question. It's a very traditional one, but do you really care about kind of, oh, I just feel a little bit uneasy about this, versus I actually can't afford to retire.
Which is what John's talking about, isn't it? I mean, if you've got very limited time left to try and make that up, I mean, you're not going to be able to. Yeah. But I'm just going to pose a stupid question here. But on hearing that, I would go, well, for God's sake, just de-risk me then. Get me out of here, because my capacity for whatever you call it, it sounds very technical, is kind of zero.
Yeah, I think to some degree you need to also think about what you're going to be doing post-retirement. And that really needs to link in. So it's true that throughout retirement, unless you have alternative sources of income, you do have relatively diminished capacity.
Yes.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean you necessarily want to be in a very low-risk solution. For example, your longevity uncertainty during retirement is going to actually, in many cases, promote taking on more risk, because if it turns out that you live a wonderfully long life, taking that risk is likely to be paid off in the long term. And if it turns out that you only actually live for a few years after retirement, well, it doesn't matter, actually, that you've taken on that extra risk.
Well, this is quite interesting because, in a way, this is about me, for instance, not just thinking about the end point of retiring, because I heard somebody say the other day, we've got to retire, this idea of retirement, you know. And in fact, there is actually some a group called The Age of No Retirement, which I rather love the idea of that. But anyway, sorry, I digress. But I guess the point is, it's a sort of to and through type of, you know, you're thinking not just to a point, but beyond. And your point, Veronica, around the capacity loss, presumably that kind of weaves into things like, you know, what's retirement going to look like, what life events have happened, what it just feels really quite a lot of factors that have to be considered here.
Yeah, and this is why there is no one-size-fits-all.
Right.
So kind of we would love to say, well, we've devised the ideal solution. This is what it is. Here are the four things you should do. But actually, obviously, from the individual point of view, this all varies massively, but also scheme by scheme. These are all the factors that we're trying to talk about that trustees and pensions managers should consider when they weigh in those opposing things as well. So on the one hand, for example, yes, kind of don't de-risk me too early because I can work longer. And I think like the number of people, percentage of people working past 70 doubled in the last 10 years. Mm. On the other hand, well, actually, that's all great. But if I'm really sort of in emerging market equities when I'm 65, that's probably not ideal either. And there is no ready-made recipe for this.
Okay, so that's a good point to pick up on this point, this discussion around diversification, because I'm going to assume I'm in a multi-asset fund, diversified. John, what's the point of all this diversification? Talk to a layman.
So in general, the idea of diversification is that you're reducing your exposure to unrewarded risk. So the idea is that different assets and different asset classes will have risk and return. But by combining those, you can substantially reduce a lot of the risk whilst maintaining a lot of the return. So that's the sort of general principle involved. But there are at different stages of your glide path, as I would call it, pre-retirement, there can be a tendency to, particularly in the early years, to have a more aggressive strategy. So it would still be, we'd still recommend a high degree of diversification within those higher return-seeking assets, but you may be less diversified across asset classes. However, there are various arguments for and against that sort of approach.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was at a conference last week, and it felt like it. You know, people bandy around the word diversification, but actually, looking at quite a lot of default funds, they're kind of pretty simplistic, and I only say that because. Can you give us a flavour of what diversification actually means and why it's a benefit to the member like me? So I'm, I don't know, 10 years from retirement or the point of retirement. Why should I still be diversified?
Well, I think the same principles apply no matter where you are. But I think you really don't want to be relying too much on one particular asset class.
So it's your point about emerging markets then. Okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So kind of I'll jump in and interrupt John with his own research. But kind of that's very exciting for me because we previously only talked about diversification from the point of view, well, you're kind of not putting all eggs in one basket. Yes. But it's also from the asset class's point of view. But there is another thing. a lot of the models and a lot of our confidence how things will perform really relies on the parameters underneath. And actually, kind of, yes, if you believe that emerging markets equity is the best thing ever and will yield you 15% each year for the next 30 years, why would you invest in anything else? Yeah. However, you need to be quite confident that that's the case. And where this is where John comes in and tells you that it's all more tricky.
Well, isn't there a lovely actuarial phrase which I learnt a few years ago called the expanding funnel of doubt? Is that right? Or have I made that up?
No, that's true. And I think this uncertainty that Veronica is talking about is really saying that actually that funnel of doubt is a little bit wider over the long term than you might have thought. Because so this assumption setting that people just normally take for granted, so when it comes to emerging market equities, for example, what you have to realise is that that setting of that number is really a subjective exercise. So obviously there's a lot of research you can do into it, but you know, fund managers and economists will disagree on this number. And even if they agree, it doesn't necessarily mean that is the right number. Yeah. And that's actually very important over the long term, because it can mean that it can mean two things, really. Firstly, you're not quite as confident that some asset classes, particularly equities, will necessarily outperform. So this can be one of the things that encourages you to not maybe take quite as much risk as you might have done. So some strategies involve basically for younger members who've got several decades ahead of them just putting all of their assets in equity. Whereas allowing for this uncertainty would promote a less risky strategy. The second point is that it can promote diversification even more than it would be promoted anyway. And that's really recognising that this uncertainty about what these expected returns should be means that you can't really be confident that, for example, emerging market equity has a higher expected return than developed equity. And that recognising that you may have got this ranking the wrong way around means that even if you're investing over a very long time period, you still want to be careful to make sure that you're diversified and you've kind of hedged your bets a bit.
Great. So that's really the kind of groundwork which stays in place. I mean, I imagine as new opportunities come along, you'll diversify further as long as there's an investment reason for doing that.
Yeah, so I think there's another layer to this, which is how exactly do you get diversification? Mm. So, and obviously, ideally, you'd have access to as many different sort of diversification opportunities as possible.
Yes. I mean, and Veronica, you, with that, this sort of overlay of diversification is as you'll see more information arising about what people are actually doing, how they're thinking about their retirement, what retirement increasingly looks like, that presumably is also informing the way in which you guys will design something for the future.
Oh, absolutely. Because if suddenly people are much more confident around the timing, or you know they all come back and start buying annuity, or they all agree on what is the investment behind the income drawdown, then obviously we can pinpoint that much better. And if everyone agrees, like with diversified growth funds, that it's in accumulation, that it's about 2/3 of equity return. So in decumulation, let's say 50% of equity return, and then kind of certain characteristic, we obviously can then tailor investment strategy onto that. What stops us now is exactly this like terrible uncertainty around kind of income drawdown can be anything. And yes, annuities are great and provide a peace of mind and guarantees, etc. But when are people actually buying them? Will they start buying them later? Will they start buying them with a part of their pot? Again, if we see that shift in the behavior that everyone starts, for example, doing 50% annuities, 50% income drawdown, again, this will give us much more confidence and this will shift the way we design these things. Currently, our problem is that it needs to be robust for the different scenarios.
Robust and flexible.
Yes.
And I guess the bit that we can't directly comment on, but within all this is a real emphasis on strong governance and you know, an ability to look through what's going on. So I guess from all we've discussed, from a trustee listening to this, you know, the key takeaways, I hate that phrase, but I've just used it, so sorry, is be aware of the risks. They're multifold, and there are several levels of risk and uncertainty. But here it's about the importance of diversification, as you said, John, really all the way through, partly to accommodate that uncertainty. But also the message I've heard loud and clear is that de-risking too early, you know, not holding on to growth assets, you know, could make a quite significant difference to what your retirement would look like. And then balancing, you know, risk against the capacity for loss, but probably steering away from asking people or putting too much emphasis on asking people about what's your capacity for loss, because it may be that their tolerance to loss is pretty low. As we get older, we probably become more conservative. But actually, from John, your point of view, that's irrelevant, because actually you've just got to focus on keeping diversified, looking for that balance of risk and return. And then as a final thing, you know, it's to and through. This isn't to a finite point. Have I kind of got anywhere near what we've been talking about in terms of summarising it?
I think that's a very good summary. One thing I would say is that I think all of these factors have some benefits, and it's really about blending them together. And there's no single right answers to doing that, but I think what you've said basically covers a lot of what we've
and discussed. This is also where your governance point comes in, because the answer in that balance changes, and as we know more about the demographics of this scheme and as it develops, the balance there will also shift. So we need to be asking the same questions fairly regularly and see how it develops.
Right, got you. Because in a way, you're designing a default for all seasons, but what you're not doing is trying to sort of second guess and say this is going to be the silver bullet. Okay,
yes.
All right. I think we're there. I wanted to ask you a slightly tongue-in-cheek end question, which was, what's making you happy in the markets at the moment? And this can be a short, pithy answer, but whatever pops to mind, John.
So one thing I think, well, it's not a particularly recent trend, but since 2016, annuity rates have increased substantially from their very low levels. And so this is quite good just from the ability for retirees to actually secure a higher level of income.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Veronica?
And for me, these are all the developments in the retirement market that kind of obviously I'm deeply personally invested because I'm working on this, but also a lot of consultations from FCA, from PLSA that are coming in with really good thinking, and it feels like there's finally momentum behind it and the member and customer focus that was probably absent 2-3 years ago. So I'm really hopeful that we'll see lots of new exciting stuff in the next year or two.
Great, fantastic. Okay, so now just for me, it leaves me to wrap up. Just to say, behind what we've been talking about is a piece of research that's coming out called Your Default or Mine. And you can read more about this on LGIM.com. But also, there will be a link at the end of this podcast, so please click on that. Thank you very much for listening.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.